everyone. I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Mo.
And this is Team Get Over It.
We're an all-female team participating in the greatest motoring adventure on the planet, the Mongo Rally.
We'll be driving 10,000 miles across mountains, deserts, and unknown terrain.
And along the way, we hope to spread our feminist and environmental ideals.
Join us here as we share our stories, thoughts, and interviews as we get ready for the Mongo Rally 2023.
Third time's the charm, I hope. Hello.
Hey.
Welcome back to this month's podcast episode. Caitlin has prepared something a little bit different for us today. Care to tell us what you're going to be talking about?
Yes. Recently, we were throwing around some options for our book club, and this book was one of the suggested readings. I was immediately interested, and I wanted to talk about it on the podcast as a kind of adventure story slash like book review.
Oh, all right. Well, it sounds interesting. So what was the book and what is it about?
So the book is called Tracks, A Woman's Solo Trek Across 1,700 Miles of Australian Outback by Robin Davidson. It's the story of a woman who decided to cross half of Australia through the desert solo in the late 1970s. And, you know, since I'm headed to Australia myself, I was immediately interested in the book. We didn't actually pick this one for book club, but I read it anyway, and I'm glad that I did.
So... what's your overall impression of the book? Was it pretty positive then?
Yeah, it wasn't exactly what I was expecting. I thought it was going to be just a basic account of the journey, but it was a very diverse book and covered a lot of topics like environmentalism and Indigenous rights. I wasn't really expecting that, and she didn't just give an objective description of the facts of her trip either. She wrote in all the good experiences and the bad, and she described in detail her emotions and mental breakdowns throughout the trip. Yeah, it was really touching and disturbing and exciting all at once.
Yeah, you can't leave out those mental breakdowns because they're part of the journey. And,
yeah.
You know, the good with the bad is what makes it great.
Yeah, no, true. And it makes it real also. Mm-hmm. And even though the book has been in print since the 80s, the writing is still really raw. Robin herself admits that she wasn't much of a writer at the time that the book was published. And I noticed a lot of awkward grammar and typos while I was reading, but it didn't really detract from the story. Rather, it was kind of charming, and it made me feel like I was listening to her telling the story rather than reading it in a filtered book. Like, it was more written in a kind of speaking style than it was in a writing style.
Right.
And it was actually surprisingly easy to read, even if it was written that way. It was pretty cool. Like I mentioned, it had all the bad parts of the trip in it, too. And, you know, sometimes it made me feel kind of icky reading it because they kept in the popular vernacular being used at the time, specifically with how certain people talked about Aboriginals in the area. But I appreciated it because it really gave you a sense of what was going on at the time, and it helped me understand Robin's feelings and reactions better.
Okay. I understand that. There are books that I have read from like the 50s or the 60s, or they're like written in like the 70s even, and they still have like the N-word in them every once in a while, and you're like, I'm like, I understand why it's there because of the time it was written in, so I get it, and it gives you the context for the situation of the story itself. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm just like, oh man.
Yeah. Like this book had one N-bomb in it. Mm-hmm. And
a couple of their drawings.
And I was like, whoa. Cause she, you know, she's very supportive of Aboriginal rights. And when I saw the word, I was a little bit shocked. I mean, I was very shocked. But like, that's just how people talked then. You know, in Australia, and like, even if you were a supporter of Aboriginal rights, then because it was just so popular to talk like that, I would assume, I guess you would just talk like that.
Right.
So, you know, instead of me thinking that Robin was racist, because like, I know she's not, it was just like, okay, well, this is what it was like, you know, this is the environment that people were living in, and No. All right. So it gives you like a better picture of what's happening.
Right. No, exactly.
Yeah. And... but it was still jarring.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of talk about this in this book, but I wanted to touch on the theme of feminism that runs through it. I was expecting something vaguely feminist. Obviously, it's like a book about mm-hmm. a solo female traveler, but
right.
I was surprised at how often the author actually brought it up overtly. Mm. I don't get the impression that the motive for the trip was a feminist one, though I guess it was part. But after reading, I wouldn't say that it's a feminist-focused book. Rather, it's just one theme of many. But I want to read some excerpts from the text that I thought were particularly poignant from a feminist point of view.
All right. Yeah. Read on.
Thank you. So the book starts off, and she goes to this place called Alice Springs, which is colloquially known as just the Alice. And it's kind of funny because, like, I was talking to my tattoo artist about going to Australia, and he mentioned going to Alice Springs, and I was like, oh, it's in my book. Yeah, and he said his reaction was like, Alice Springs is a weird place. And then so whenever she arrives in Alice Springs, because she's originally from Brisbane, like, she talks about her arrival in Alice as if she's kind of going to an alien planet. Like, I guess the atmosphere there is just totally different than other places in Australia. It's more wild. You know, it's a kind of an outpost. The people there have a different way of living. And at first it was really hard for her to adjust, but living in Alice obviously changed her. So I want to read like this part where she's talking about living in Alice. So she says, I had been in the Alice for almost a year now, and I was a changed woman. It seemed I had always been there, that anything I may have been before was a dream belonging to someone else. My grip on reality was a little shaky. I wanted to see my friends again because I was beginning to realize how removed from everything but camels and madmen I had become. The time with Kurt had a weird effect on me. I was self-protective, suspicious, defensive, and I was also aggressively ready to pounce on anyone who looked like they might be going to give me a hard time. Though this may sound like a negative quality, it was essential for me to develop beyond the archetypal female creature who from birth had been trained to be sweet, pliable, forgiving, compassionate, and doormat-ish. Hmm. So and the part that I liked about that is like specifically the female creature part, because it's right. true. And like, you know, I've had a lot of this conversation with one of my friends, one of my coworkers. She's from the Midwest in America. And mm-hmm. I think like Midwest kind of culture is really similar to Canadian culture in particular. So I totally get everything that she's saying, but it's true. Like, you know, her and I talk about like how from birth, you know, girls are raised differently than boys are. And we are trained to be sweet. And it's like, you know, my mom always told me that I had to be kind to everybody.
Right. Or that, you know, it's better if you smile more.
Yeah. Like you're a girl, yeah. Smile more. And like, you need to use your charms and you always have to be nice. And my friend from the Midwest, like, she talks about like how, you know, the men in their family, the brothers and fathers and stuff, would be more aggressive, but it was the woman's job to, I don't know, curtail the man's aggressiveness, but she herself could never be aggressive. And so she would just have to be, sweetie, you know, you need to. And, you know, my mom always told me, like, whenever someone's being aggressive to you or being mean to you, you just have to reply to them in kindness. But, you know, men are more taught that it's like tit for tat or an eye for an eye.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's just like, yeah. And like, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot lately. And so I read that part of the book and I was like, you know what? You're so right.
No, I see that in other people, but I love my mother because she didn't raise me that way.
Oh, nice.
She raised me to be a strong, independent individual who fought for what I thought was right, fought for my feelings, and shouldn't be scared or ashamed to have my feelings and, you know, say what I wanted to say. And
that's great.
Granted, I was a very shy child to begin with, and like I wanted to be a wallflower for the longest time, but I never felt like I had to be forgiving or compassionate to others except for what I heard from church. Or I didn't have to be a doormat.
My mom's a big church.
Except for all the things I heard from church.
Yeah, my mom was always like, turn the other cheek and blah blah blah.
I'm not going to turn the other cheek if they ain't.
Exactly. And, you know, and like, I don't want people to walk all over me. And anyway, so, yeah, I, you know, thankfully I'm like a really stubborn person. So I don't think I've ever been that particularly that sweet or pliable or doormatish for that matter.
But you grew up with that culture, hearing it.
But I did. Yeah, I grew up with it, but it just, you know, it went in one ear and out the other, thankfully. But, you know, now as an adult, I'm kind of like looking back on the things that I heard when I was younger and like, wow, that wasn't cool. Like, thank God it didn't actually stick with me at all.
Right.
Yeah, I'm a totally different person.
I think the closest I ever got to hearing like my parents directly say anything similar to that kind of ideal of like a woman being the quiet, submissive kind of person was there was one time where they were having a party and I was just being loud and trying to interject myself constantly. And I was like 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. And my mom's like, all right, Maureen, if you want to be here, you need to be seen, not heard. So go sit over there and shut up. And I'm like, fair enough. And it was more just because it was an adult conversation. And while I wanted to be involved, they were having their adult time. Yeah. So I had to respect that. It was more what it was rather than you're a girl, you shouldn't talk kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Poor choice of words, maybe, but I understand the sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anyways.
That's so funny. But yeah, so like throughout, so in her time in Alice Springs, she's changing and, you know, she's kind of progressively more and more like moving out into the bush. Like she, you know, kind of stops living in houses and lives in a tent for like forever and whatever. And she's interacting with all these different people. So she's changing a lot. And then before her trip, she kind of goes back to Brisbane to like talk to her friend Nancy. And she's finding it hard to kind of connect with these people because like she's changed so much. Even like her best friend, she's like, oh, what do I do? And like, I'm really different now. So right. She says this. So she has this conversation with her friend Nancy before like leaving on her trip. But after living in the Alice for a while, and her friend says to her, Rob, I really like what you're doing. I didn't understand it before, but getting off your butt and actually doing something for yourself is important for all of us. And I guess us meaning women. Mm-hmm. And although I can't say I won't miss you like hell and won't worry about you often, I can say that what you're doing is great and I love you for it. It's important that we leave each other and the comfort of it and circle away, even though it's hard sometimes, so that we can come back and swap information about what we've learned, even if what we do changes us and we risk not recognizing each other when we return.
Hmm.
And I thought that was really powerful because, and I think her friend is so supportive and so awesome. Yeah. And, you know, like, and what she says is so true because, you know, I think about this a lot. Like I'm very active on social media. And one of the reasons why is because it's just a great place to connect with people and share information. And I think it's important for women to go out in the world and have these experiences firsthand so they can tell other women, their friends, their family members, whatever, about what it's really like in the world. Because so many of us are kind of removed from the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I share my story of like traveling to South Korea, traveling to Japan, traveling to Ireland by myself. And there are people who are just shocked. They're like, you've traveled by like you went to South Korea. Was that a military thing? I'm like, no, it wasn't military. I'm like, yes, I currently live near a military base. But just because I live here doesn't necessarily mean that the reason I went somewhere else was because of the military.
Mm.
I went by myself and that like that aspect of it just shocks people. It's not necessarily the going to South Korea or going to wherever overseas. It's the I did it by myself because I could.
Yeah, exactly. And then you can give that, like share that experience like secondhand and hopefully inspire others. And I mean, and like that's what's happening here. And it's like, you know, even though, you know, we're going to be apart and stuff, like, you know, whatever you're doing is important for all of us, like as a collective. So I was like, that's. And it's true. Like, I mean, what she did was really important for women as a collective. And she kind of touches back on that a little bit later as well. And then she has some like interesting quips about men also. And like part of her experience and part of her trip, and especially living in Alice Springs, was that she's kind of like, I mean, she's guilty of all, like the rest of us are. Like sometimes we feel like we need a partner. We need that strong, protective man. And you know, and I've heard so many times from my girlfriends, like they say, like, you know, I want a boyfriend who's going to protect me. Right. So I think a lot of us do have this idea and like, you know, of this white knight who's going to save us and stuff. But she,
I don't necessarily want a white knight. I just want somebody who can put up with my personality. Somebody who can match my personality and not be mowed over by it, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah. But like, I know a lot of ladies here who, mm-hmm. you know, they have that kind of idea and they're just like, oh, like, you know, I don't go out without my boyfriend so he can kind of protect me from other men. And I'm like, okay, fair. Cause like the men here are super predatory, but at the same time, like it's kind of limiting in our own lives. And then, you know, and I think, right. I think having that feeling like I need to have a protector sort of limits you in a lot of ways. So, mm-hmm. and she's realizing this when she's living in the Alice. So she said, I had somehow always countered my desire for a white knight in shining armor by forming bonds with men I didn't like, or with men who were so off the air there was no hope of a permanent relationship. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I have a friend who, like, you know, she is so focused on just finding a partner that, mm-hmm. like finding a man protector that she ends up dating these, like, really horrible guys and she stays in relationships for way longer than she should.
Right.
Yeah, and it's like, this guy sucks, but I think, like, a lot of people don't want to be alone. Mm-hmm. So anyways, yeah. I thought that was kind of interesting. And so she's realizing this and didn't want to be alone. And, you know, at first, like, when she was living out in the bush, I think she found it very kind of alienating and almost kind of crushing in a sense. But then later she starts getting used to being alone and she actually seems to prefer it. So she said, so now, for the first time in my life, my aloneness was a treasure which I guarded like a jewel.
Yep.
Which I liked. And, you know, as an, like, I mean, people are really surprised when I say this, but, you know, I'm introverted. Like, I prefer being alone and doing things alone. So, like, I personally, like, I thought that line was really good. And I was like, that's how I feel. I treasure my alone time.
I like my alone time, but my alone time is usually like me cooped up in my house doing stuff. When I'm traveling, I prefer to have a buddy just so I have somebody to talk to and share the experience with.
Yeah. I guess when she says alone, she doesn't mean alone alone because she had her animals with her. So she right. did the journey with four camels and her dog. And, you know, her dog became her best friend, but she started to kind of almost shun the company of other humans, but right. in so doing, because she wasn't so like surrounded by people all the time, she was able to get more in touch with herself, like her own mm-hmm. feelings, and work out a lot of her own emotions. And she was also able to get closer to the earth. Like she was talking about having this like really deep connection with nature throughout the trip. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which was really cool. I thought that was neat. And I feel like that. I feel like because I like traveling alone, and I feel like when I'm traveling alone, I have more of a connection with the place that I'm traveling to because I'm more focused on it instead of like being distracted by another person.
Right. That's fair.
Plus, I just like to do whatever I want to do when I want to do it, which I can do more freely right when I'm doing like traveling alone.
Right. Right. No, that's fair. And I'm generally like, me and Jess found out that we're good travel buddies because she generally has like a bunch of things that she wants to do. And I'm just kind of like, I'm along for the ride. I'm here to be here and experience the travel and like be in the country. I don't necessarily have plans of like, I must go see this. I must do blah, blah, blah. I'm just
right.
I'm just kind of along for the experience to see what happens and enjoy it.
And I mean, and yeah, you and Jess and Sam, like you guys are all like, even though I prefer traveling alone, I like traveling with you guys too, because you guys have traveled so much and so respectful of other people's needs. And it's like, yeah. Cause like Sam, like when I was traveling with Sam in Bali, for example, she'd be like, oh, I just need to spend some time alone. I'd be like, okay, bye. You know, and we'd just like go our separate ways. Yeah. Like, it's like, oh, I want to go see this thing. So I'm just going to take off. And it's like, okay, bye. Like, That's the kind of like, yeah, if I'm going to travel with somebody, that's the kind of person that I want to travel with.
Right.
Because yeah, like, you know, we need our own space sometimes. And like, Oh, and, hell yeah. And, you know, and I'm a big fan of, because like in Korea, the culture is very sort of like collective here. So like usually you do things together in a group and you all do the same thing together and you're with each other all the time. And when I tell my students that I like to travel alone, they're always like extremely shocked, like more shocked than if I tell other people. But for them, they're just like, it's not so much the safety aspect, but they're always wondering if I feel lonely. And it's just cause I'm alone, I don't feel lonely. And I think for a while, like Robin on her trip, she was feeling lonely. But then she kind of overcame that and she realized, oh, like, you know, I'm not lonely. I have my dog, I have my camels, I have myself. And then she just started.
I may be alone, but I'm not lonely.
Yeah, and I thought that transformation was really interesting. Like as an introverted person, I was like, oh, I totally get what she's talking about.
Yeah.
But then you know there were times during her trip where she would have to stop in at outposts, I guess, and stations. They call them kind of stations. For I guess dotted all along the desert in certain areas, there are these really remote kind of outposts with like very few white people and kind of more aboriginals. But like it's a lot of ranchers and it's miners and just random government officials. And these are people who are used to living off the land. So they're quite crusty. So she talks about going into one place, and this is like after being alone for like, I don't know, a couple of days or a couple of weeks or something. And she walks into a bar and then she's talking about like these men having a conversation, you know, like locker room talk, for lack of a better term. But she describes that like this. She says, I went into the bar for a beer, there to be met by a group of typical awkers, all talking as is their wont about sex and Sheilas. Oh, great, I thought. Just what I need, some intellectual stimulation. One of them, an ugly, weedy, pimply little brute, had been a milkman in Melbourne and was entertaining his mates with gruesomely detailed stories of his countless conquests of sex-starved housewives. Another had been a tourist bus driver who said driving was a terrible ball drainer because all the women were always after his body. God knows there was enough of it. His beer gut was popping the buttons on his shirt. I left. Yeah, so she just like, you know, she goes from that kind of revelation that she had earlier, you know, to being like, you know, I kind of wanted a man so much that I would spend a lot of time with these gross men. And then she walks into this bar, witnesses that kind of man firsthand. And she's just like, you know what? I'm outie. And then she just leaves immediately.
Yep. Walks into the bar, sees what's happening, goes, nah.
Nah. Yeah. And I think like, you know, being on her own for so long and it really made her realize that, you know, she doesn't need the company of this kind of person anymore. And she's like, you know what? I'm just going to peace out. Bye. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Over here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm just gonna bounce and like, I think a lot of women have that kind of feeling also. Like, how many times have I been with a group of people? Like, well, it happened a couple weekends ago. Like, I wasn't really participating in the conversation at all because I was like fine just sipping on my drink off to the side alone. But like, I was out at the clubs and we ended up hanging out with these two dudes. And one of them I knew because he lives in my apartment building. So, you know, we just kind of ran into each other and I was like, oh, hey, like we know each other. And then we ended up drinking with them. And like the men were talking about like really uncomfortable things. And I just like, was like, I'm not going to participate in this conversation. But I think a lot of women do have that. And they feel like because of what we were talking about before, like being sweet and being accommodating, you know, they feel like they have to put up with derogatory comments and crude language.
You don't feel like you can say anything or get up and leave or be like, hey, you know, that's not really appropriate. There are other people around.
But like, and like, here it is. She's like, you know, after like having this realization, she's just like, you know what? I'm outie. See ya. Like, I don't want to listen to this. Even at the risk of like appearing rude or snobbish or whatever. Right. So she's just like, you know what? Bye. I don't want to listen. So I thought that was really nice. And then throughout her journey, like she's talking about being a woman and traveling solo and stuff. And like, she's reflecting on the culture, I guess, in Australia and the relationships between men and women and like, you know, what men think of women and what women think of themselves. And then, mm-hmm. you know, and she's spending a lot of time with Aboriginal people and she has a really great respect for them. So she's like, she's kind of learning a little bit of like one Aboriginal language. I'm not sure if it's like the predominant one or not. It seemed like it was. And she was talking to a lot of Aboriginal people and I guess she was learning about them and about their culture. And so, and she says this, which I thought was interesting, but she said, "I remember one story, which I have never had verified, but which rings true, concerning a myth belonging to some tribe in Western Australia. In the beginning, the women had everything. They had the power to procreate, they supported the tribe and kept them alive with their knowledge of bush foods, and they had a natural superiority. They also had the knowledge, which they kept hidden in a secret cave. The men conspired to steal this knowledge so that things would be more balanced." And like, now here comes the crunch. "The women heard this and instead of stopping them, realized that this was the way things had to go for the sexes to remain in harmony. They allowed the men to steal this knowledge, which has remained in their hands until today."
Hmm.
Yeah, because I think she was remarking like she I think this happened just after she had witnessed one of her friends had met his wife and she was struck by like how he reacted to seeing his wife. Like she was describing his face as just being like so happy and respectful and kind of blissful and stuff. And she was surprised to see a man looking at his wife like that. And then it kind of like, and then it sort of brought up this memory of this story. Interesting that she's saying that like they didn't stop them from stealing that knowledge and like becoming superior. And they were just like, oh, this is the way. But it kind of reminded me of like my middle, Midwestern friend had said that like, you know, women are supposed to be the arbitrators, I guess, and the peacekeepers. Mm-hmm. And like, this is kind of exactly what was happening here. Like, you know, being a peacekeeper and like just right. kind of letting people walk all over them. And it also makes me think like, you know, if the positions had been reversed, like if women were stealing this knowledge from men and men knew about it, they would have like dug their foots in and fought really hard.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah, they would have. They're like, no, you don't deserve to have access to this or whatever. They would have said something along those lines. Maybe not deserve, but.
Yeah. Eh. And like, yeah. And like, I don't know if I like this story because like, you know, it's kind of making it seem like women are cool with men being superior to them for the sake of peace. Mm-hmm. But that's obviously changing.
Right.
I think a lot of women are not cool with it anymore. But like,
I think a lot of women are no longer okay with just keeping the status quo.
Yeah.
Which is what the story is kind of suggesting that women do is be like, you know, it's okay to let them have steal this knowledge so long as it keeps the status quo, so long as it keeps the peace.
And this is like apparently like an Aboriginal story. Mm-hmm. And what's the word? Like, as she says, it rings true. It might not be a true story, but it seems like because like it's, this is sort of the story of like women all over.
Right. It's the parable of women all over. There used to be a lot more matriarchal societies out there, but they've all either died off or been killed off culturally in a sense, because in Western cultures, it's more dominant for it to be a patriarchal society.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of people see and hear. And so a lot of those cultures have switched or transformed.
And it's interesting, like, you know, what is it? Just the coveting of the power, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think women covet power. And, like, that's kind of what's happening in this story, too. Like, women don't covet power the same way that men do.
Right.
And I've noticed, and I've been noticing this, like, with a couple of, like, my male friends and stuff. And these days, like, with so many men following the likes of Joe Rogan and like Jordan Peterson and Andrew Tate. To be honest, I've never read any of their stuff, but like just from how people talk, like how men talk about those men, mm-hmm. I can get an idea of what those men are touting. And it's usually about power. It's like, you're a man, you need to get power and you need to do this to get power. And I just don't understand why they need to have so much power. Like, why are you coveting it so much? And like, I guess like this is what that story is. It's about like coveting power and like women don't and men do.
Right.
It's really interesting. So anyway, it's an interesting story. So I wanted to put it in. And the story exists kind of everywhere. And then so, and like I said before, so she's traveling through the desert. She's not exactly alone. She has her camels. And then her love of animals comes up a lot in the story. Like she talks about how much she loves the camels, and she talks about like having a baby crow, and she has her dog, and she had two dogs at one point. One of them died. And, but she's also like, she is an animal lover, but at the same time, she also talks about like hitting the camels, like whenever they're acting up, she like smacks them. And she shot one of her camels, like her camels was really sick. And I mean, like, you know, I guess it's a mercy, but you know, she shot one of her camels, and even she had a pet crow at one point. And the way that she got her pet crow was extremely violent. It wasn't her. It wasn't exactly her. It was another person who did this, but she was there as a bystander and she didn't stop it. But they just knocked a nest out of a tree, and there were like a bunch of baby crows in it, all of which died except for one. So she kind of like, because she wanted a pet crow, she caused the death of three.
Right.
Right. And like, so like she's an animal lover, but like there's also this violence, which is kind of interesting.
I understand it because I grew up on a farm and I work with farm animals, and I love my dogs, but at the same time I raise chickens for meat.
Right.
And so, you know, I have to take care of that messy process so that I can have food in my stomach. And it would shock a lot of people to hear about it and, you know, to have to deal with that or do it themselves. But for me, it's just, you know, it's a thing that I do because that's just how I live. But that doesn't stop me from loving animals.
Yeah. And like, and then she's like, she's in the bush, like she's working on a kind of camel farm ranch sort of thing. And like they have to be able to control it. Anyway. So like it was interesting. It was interesting. But she is an animal lover. So. And then she said this, which I guess is kind of true because I get this. But she says, animal lovers, especially female ones, are often accused of being neurotic and unable to relate successfully to other human beings. How many times had friends noted my relationship to Diggity? That's her dog. And with that baleful look usually associated with psychiatrists, said, you've never thought of having a child, have you? It's an accusation that brings an explosive response every time, because it seems to me that the good Lord, in his infinite wisdom, gave us three tilings to make life bearable: hope, jokes, and dogs. But the greatest of these was dogs. But especially that part where it's like, oh, you love your dogs that much? You've never thought of having a child?
Right. Well, I mean, there's so many people who start off with and you'll hear them talk about, especially in the U.S., they'll be like, oh, you know, here's my baby. Let me show you the pictures of my baby. And it's their dog or their cat. And everybody's just like, aren't you planning on having kids? And it's like,
no.
Well, yeah, eventually, maybe. But for right now, this is my baby.
But it's that, it's also that, like, because she's saying, like, you know, people would look at me like I was crazy.
Right.
Because I prefer dogs than having a child, pretty much.
Right.
And I'm like, man, bruh, like, I mean, I like cats too, but I don't have any pets at the moment. You know, in general, I don't want kids, but I can relate to that whenever I tell people, oh, I don't want kids. And especially in Korea, because like the goal for men and for women is both. It's like to like get married, have kids. It's like what the government pushes. That's what parents push. It's what everyone pushes. And so like when my students ask me, because it comes up often, do you want to get married? I don't want to get married to anybody. And they are shocked. And then their follow-up question is always, well, what about children? And I'm like, I don't want to have kids. And then they're double shocked. How could you? And like even like in Korea too, because we're experiencing such a horrible birth rate. Like our birth rate is very low. And it's really concerning a lot of people, and especially the government. And there was an article that I read about a year ago, I think, where this government minister actually said that women were selfish for not having children. And but I think a lot of people have that kind of sentiment, and not just in Korea, but also abroad. And it's like, because women are, like the Aboriginal story said, like, you know, women are the life givers. So if you want to have more people on Earth, then you need women's compliance for it. And then if women don't comply, then you're kind of shit out of luck. So, yep. So that, but that reaction is pretty common from people when you say you don't want to have kids.
I mean, at the same time though, isn't there a statistic out there that's saying that if the birth rates globally continue the way that they are, that we will outpace what resources we currently have available to feed all the people on the planet?
That's what I've said to like a lot of my students. So anyway, and then so back to Robin. So she's, and you know, we have friends like John, for example. We did an interview with him earlier. We have friends who do through hiking, which you're just alone-ish, like in the woods for months on end. And, you know, you kind of end up going a little bit crazy, for lack of a better word, but you're not crazy, but you're just thinking in a very different way. Yes. And you sort of become desocialized, I think is a better word. So while she's walking, she's really getting desocialized. And she talks about it a lot. And it's always really interesting when she does talk about it, because you're like, I understand the mindset that she's in. And I go, yeah. So she talks a lot about like how she's changing. So here she says, "By now, I was utterly deprogrammed. I walked along naked, usually clothes being not only putrid, but unnecessary. My skin had been baked a deep terracotta brown and was the constituency of harness leather. The sun no longer penetrated it. I retained my hat because my nose had peeled so often I thought it might disappear altogether. I might be left with just a bare lump of sizzling cartilage sticking out there. And I honestly could not remember or put into context etiquette. Did it matter? I would think to myself, if all the buttons had gone from my shirt and trousers, would anybody notice or care? And what about menstrual blood? From my position, it didn't matter a damn whether it followed the natural laws of gravity and ran down my leg the way it was meant to do. But would others feel the same? Would it make them confused and unhappy? But why on earth would it? I wouldn't cover a cut in embarrassment, would I? I was in an agony of confusion because I just didn't know. I'm amazed at how quickly and absolutely the sense of the importance of social customs fell away from me. And the awareness of its absurdity has really never left me. I have slowly regained a sense of the niceties, but I hope that I will always see the obsession with social graces and female modesty for the perverted, crippling insanity it really is."
Nice.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, I liked that. And I liked especially that last part, because it is crippling and it's perverted. Mm-hmm. It's very strange. This whole like female modesty stuff. And, you know, luckily we were born in an age where women could wear pants comfortably and it wasn't really a big deal. But like, this is like, and she's talking about this is the late 1970s.
Yeah.
And, you know, even my mom, because like my mom was born in 56, Robin was born in 50. And like my mom was saying, you know, in her circles, in her time, it was really rare for women to wear pants.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she remembered
skirts.
Yeah, like they exactly. And then so she remembered like getting comments from people when she did wear pants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and she thought she was like a huge badass for like going around in pants. And it's like, so that's like what's happening here. So, I mean, and we still do experience some of that today. And it's like, you're a woman, you shouldn't do that. Or you're a woman, you shouldn't talk like that. And it's like, it's weird.
Yeah. Or, you know, on the extreme side, when there's victim blaming for situations.
Oh, God, yeah.
What were you wearing? It's like, it doesn't matter what I was wearing. I'm the victim. Why are you trying to put the blame on me and my clothing? Like, fuck you. Sorry.
No, you're right, though. Like, I mean, yeah, that's so true. And
that's a very extreme example, but yes.
Yeah. But I think we've all experienced that. And well, it kind of brings to mind, because I was talking about this recently, but, you know, I think – I don't have the confirmation because I never got like tested, but I'm pretty sure I got like drugged once.
Oh, shit.
And I remember telling people about it and they were like, "Oh, maybe you shouldn't go to bars anymore."
You're like, "Oh yeah, sure."
And I was like, "Why?
Why should I have to stop going to bars because somebody drugged me?"
Yeah.
Because somebody thought like, that it was a great idea to put something unwanted, unwarranted into my beverage.
And a lot of people tell me, like, you know, there are those very conservative people who are like, "Oh, you're a woman and you go out and drink. with strangers. Like, that's not what you shouldn't be doing that. It's not part of women, female modesty or blah, blah, blah. And like, see what bad things happen to you when that, when you do that. And it's like, what a crazy way of thinking. And it's just like, and like, that's where she's at. Like, she's kind of thinking about these norms, quote unquote norms, in a critical way. And she's realizing that it's crazy.
Yeah. 100%.
I know. And like, and people might call her the crazy one, but who's really crazy, right?
Right. Is it society in general that's crazy, or is it her, me, the individual who has decided to step outside of society's norms?
Right.
Who knows? But I definitely am on board with the whole, like, I shouldn't have to worry about whether or not I'm going to get drugged when I go out to have drinks with people. But I'm always worried about it. So I'm constantly, like, I follow two rules when I'm outside drinking with people. Mm-hmm. One, if I put my drink down, the drink is dead to me. It no longer belongs to me. It belongs to the wind. Because who knows if somebody's touched it, somebody's drank from it, or whatever. It's gone. It no longer exists. And then two, if I'm getting a drink, whether it's somebody buying me a drink or whatever, unless it's a trusted friend, I go to the bar and watch that bartender pour that drink for me so that I know I'm going into it.
Because, like, I just get caught up in, like, having fun and stuff, and I'm guilty of, like, leaving my drinks out and not watching people. Don't be like me. I'm not as vigilant as I should be.
As Caitlin's friend, there have been a couple of times where she set her drink down, and I purposely, without you noticing, took your drink and moved it way, way away, and or, like,
thank just you.
Threw it away for you.
I appreciate it.
I'm watching out for you. So there's a reason why some people call me the mom of the group.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it, because, like, oh, God, Lord knows I don't really watch out for myself, but yeah. But all good advice. Please do that, you know, out there, everybody. Because, like, I had a male friend.
Not just girls, guys too. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I had a male friend who got drugged. So everybody, like, watch your shit.
Yep.
This also goes hand in hand with what we're talking about. But she talks about this as well. She says, and I just thought this part was really funny, but also true. So she says, in fact, to this day, I think one of the major breakthroughs I made on that trip was learning the gentle art of farting. I had never farted before. Well, maybe once or twice, but then only pathetic little. God knows what happened to all that air. Must have seeped through the pores of my skin at night, I suppose. But now I could blart with the best of them. Good, solid bass thrums, which spooked the camels and scared flocks of Spinifex pigeons into the air. Diggity and I had competitions. She always won for poisonousness. I for sonorousness. So I guess her dog had really stinky farts, but, like, you know, hers were really loud. And I totally get that, because, like, I guess my mom was pretty, like, open with farting. If it was just us, but, like, you know, in public, you can't do that. You can't burp and fart in public. And then, when I like started living with roommates and stuff, like, you know, at first I was, like, really careful with my bodily functions, like farting and burping and stuff. And then, you know what, like, at some point there was a breaking point and I was like, bro, this is my house. I want to be comfortable in my own house. I'm going to, like, burp and fart around you guys. And they were just like, sounds great, us too. And then, so we would just, like, let her rip. And, like, you know, my roommate would let a fart out and I'd be like, 8 out of 10, not bad. We would literally, like, we would literally judge each other's, like, burps and farts and stuff. And it was great. And it was so nice.
I did that with my roommates at college too.
Yeah.
And then we also, terrible game. It was an all girls dorm. So it was just literally 8 of us girls living in this dorm room together. And we barfed and farted occasionally, you know, like, made jokes and, like, rated each other depending on who was in the room.
Yeah.
We'd also walk around, like, in the morning after we got dressed, or if we were, like, waiting for other people to get dressed and get ready for, like, a night out. We just, like, walk over and be like, hey, how's it going? Like, poke them in the boob. Be like, is that your nipple?
Yeah.
It was, like, a terrible game. I hate admitting that we did that, but it's also, like, a thing we did because we were all so comfortable with each other because we were like, yeah, farting, burping, whatever. It's bodily function. We're just going to go for it.
Yeah.
And a little further, too.
But, like, sometimes when I'm, like, telling people, like, I'm like, yeah, like, you know, we did this when we were living together and et cetera. And they're a little bit mortified and they're like, you're a girl, you shouldn't do that. And it's like, oh, man, fuck off. Like,
right?
Girls got to fart too.
Right? Everybody farts. Get over it. Yeah. I honestly have not run into anybody who's just like, who has said that to me in public since I turned like 18. Nobody has publicly tried to shame me or like personally tried to shame me for farting or burping in public. It's up until that point though, I had gotten a couple of like, oh, you really shouldn't do that in public, or oh, you know, don't be like that. Yeah. And I will admit, I crop dusted my kids a couple.
Oh my god, I crop dusted the kids all the time.
I was all just like, I got a fart, and I can't like leave the classroom, so guess I'm making a lap.
Yeah.
It was terrible. Just, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Anyway, no, it's true. It's true. I used to do that too. Oops. But all right. So the next part is kind of long, but like this is really, she ended up like, to help her fund her trip. She, because like it was supposed to be like just a personal journey. But she ended up making a deal with National Geographic, and they gave her some money to like, because she was pretty broke at the beginning of it. So she needed the money to like get her gear and get ready. But she felt really horrible about it. Like she felt like she was ruining the trip somehow, even when she did that. She did not want publicity. That's not the reason why she did this. She didn't want to become famous at all. And then suddenly, like near the end of her trip, people were starting to like try to track her down so they could get interviews with her and photos and stuff. And she couldn't really understand why she was so famous. Because she's like, I'm not really, like, I mean, what I'm doing is, like, cool, I guess. But she says it's not to this level.
Right.
So she couldn't understand it. So then she was thinking about it, and, like, this was her conclusion. It's a little long, but I think it's good. So she says, and it was only then that I realized what I had let myself in for. And only then I realized how bloody thick I had been not to have predicted it. It would seem that the combination of elements, woman, desert, camels, aloneness, hit some soft spot in the era's passionless, heartless, aching psyche. It fired the imaginations of people who see themselves as alienated, powerless, unable to do anything about the world gone mad. And wouldn't it be my luck to pick just this combination? The reaction was totally unexpected, and it was very, very weird. I was now public property. I was now a feminist symbol. I was now an object of ridicule for small-minded sexists. And I was a crazy, irresponsible adventurer, though not as crazy as I would have been had I failed. But worse than all that, I was now a mythical being who had done something courageous and outside the possibilities that ordinary people could hope for. And that's the antithesis of what I wanted to share, that anyone could do anything. And if I could bumble my way across a desert, then anyone could do anything. And that was true, especially for women, who have used cowardice for so long to protect themselves that it has become a habit. The world is a dangerous place for little girls. Besides, little girls are more fragile, more delicate, more brittle than little boys. Watch out. Be careful. Watch. Don't climb trees. Don't dirty your dress. Don't accept lifts from strange men. Listen, but don't learn. You won't need it. And so the snail's antenna grew. Watching for this, looking for that, the underneath of things, the threat. And so she wastes so much of her energy seeking to break those circuits, to push up the millions of tiny thumbs that have tried to quench energy and creativity and strength and self-confidence that have so effectively caused her to build fences against possibility, daring, that have to effectively kept her imprisoned inside her notions of self-worthlessness. And now a myth was being created where I could appear different, exceptional. Because society needed it to be so. Because if people started living out their fantasies and refusing to accept the fruitless boredom that is offered them as normality, they would become hard to control. And that term, camel lady, had I been a man, I'd be lucky to get a mention in the Waluna Times, let alone international press coverage. Neither could I imagine them coining the phrase camel gentleman. Camel lady had that nice patronizing, belittling ring to it. Labeling, pigeonholing, what a splendid trick it is. Yeah, and I like that last part, because especially like that part where she's talking about, you know, how because of what we're told as we're growing up, like, don't do this, don't do that, don't get your dress dirty, don't accept lifts from strange men. That's a good point. Like, probably don't do that. But I don't mean to say that it's not, because the world is dangerous for women. Mm-hmm. The world is kind of scary sometimes, but I think
you shouldn't let that stop you from
doing what you want.
Exploring your dreams and exploring and following the possibilities that you have in your mind.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, that's kind of how I live my life. And like, you know, I'm not unaware of the danger at all, but at the same time, like, I just don't want to let my fears for things stop me from doing what I want to do. So, and a lot of people think that I'm crazy and that, well, you know, I'm cool with that. But so I said, like throughout this whole book, you know, I found myself relating to the author more than I thought I would. The way she talks about being in the desert and having to readjust to society and the reverse culture shock and going crazy really reminds me of through hikers, like I mentioned, and even how I sometimes feel coming back after a trip, or like when I went back to work after quarantine or something. Mm-hmm. And that last bit that I read out, you know, really hit me, because I often have thoughts like this myself. I don't think she's saying that women shouldn't be cautious, because that's how you end up dead in many cases, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think we let our fear rule our lives and, you know, prevents us from being free. I love traveling alone. And when I tell people my travel plans, they are always pretty shocked. You know, I don't think they have the same reaction when a man tells them that they're doing some solo trip. And like my female friends and family sometimes say that they wish they could do what I'm doing. And I'm like, you can though.
The only thing I wish is that I was still in Korea.
Yeah. And like echoing what Robin said, you know, I'm just a person the same as anybody else. Mm-hmm. If I can do it, others can. And you know what? Others can probably even do it better than me, you know, but it's like,
and others have and are doing it too.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's like, you know, we've let our own fear and society's contrivances like influence us too much, to the point where we've half willingly stifled our own existence. It's really devastating. It's really bad. And, you know, part of the reason why I do what I do is because, you know, I want to do those things. So I just do them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the other part is like, because I kind of wanted to stick it to people. Well, it's, you know, I see their shock and I see their kind of like tisking and stuff, mm-hmm, as a challenge, you know, and I want to challenge society too. At the same time, I want to stick it to the patriarchy and just be like, look at me, I'm going.
Yep. Well, I was the same way. Like, when I was in high school, I wanted to travel to China. Oh, and yeah. I did, but it was as a group with a lot of my classmates, and it was, mm-hmm, mostly boys, and there were a few girls, mm-hmm, and I was one of the only students who went who actually had taken Chinese or Mandarin, mm-hmm, during high school. Like, I was the only one who took Mandarin classes.
No.
Who went, and I was like, why is nobody else from my class who's like learning Mandarin going on this goddamn trip? Why? Mm. But anyways, so it was just really interesting. And then like later on, when I went to Japan for my study abroad, a lot of people were really shocked that I was going by myself.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, oh, are you traveling? Like, are you going with a program? Are you going with a group of people? I'm like, oh, no, I'm just going by myself. Like, the program's through the school, but like, I'm traveling by myself alone to Japan, to a school I've never been to before, and it's going to be fine. And they're just like, they were so shocked. And some of the guys were like, oh, but is that safe? Are you going to be okay? I'm like, it's Japan, please. Japan is like one of the safest countries, like, calm down.
Yeah.
And then it happened again when I was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go to South Korea. I got a lot of the looks, a lot of the tisking, a lot of the, are you sure, is that safe, well, what if you get kidnapped? And I'm like, who's gonna kidnap this 5'8" almost 200 pound woman? Nobody. nobody's gonna try and kidnap me, because it requires a lot more effort than they're willing to put in. It was just really interesting, because I have experienced that, and it wasn't just from men, it was also from other women, and I was just,
yeah,
like, guys, like, if you want to go travel, and like, I hear so many people say, oh, one day, or oh, someday soon, oh, in the future, like, I had a high school buddies, like, four high school friends that were super, I was super tight with, and we're all like, one day, we're all going to live in Japan together, it's going to be great. I'm the only one who has spent any extended time in Japan.
Yeah.
Well, this book is definitely on my to read list.
Yeah.
I think I was actually the one who recommended it as like a couple.
You were.
Of options. I was like, this one sounds good, and this one, and this one. Granted, I have had no time to do any reading whatsoever because my entire life is absorbed with schoolwork. But anyways, so I think that's enough for today, if you're willing to call it an end. All right. Yeah, I'm so good. Yeah. So if you liked today's episode, please like, comment, subscribe, and share on whatever platform you're listening to this on. It really helps us out.
And consider becoming a patron on Patreon. Patrons get access to exclusive content, AMAs, and more. All proceeds will be donated to the Center for Reproductive Rights and Cool Earth. All links in the description.
Check out our website, social media pages for updates and blog posts. Links in the description.
Wow. Thanks again and see you next month.
Bye.
Bye.
That's it for today, folks.
Thanks so much for tuning in.
And as always, please support this work by subscribing and donating to our cause at www.teamgetoverit.com.
Donors get access to specific content like stickers, t-shirts, and postcards from our journey.
You can donate for as little as $5 and the benefits build from there.
Go to our website for more info.
Or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Team Get Over It.
Thanks for listening.
And catch us next time on Get Over It.
I used to have like two screens, but I sold my monitor, so I only have the one screen. So I'm just, you know, I can't see you. I'm just gonna talk and read the screen.
That's fine. I'll just make faces at you.
Okay. Oh, and you start.
Okay.
Whenever you're ready.
3, 2, 1. Caitlin has prepared.
Where did I write this? Yeah.
I can't talk. I'm sorry.
That's good. I think that's a good episode. It's not bad.